fasten your seatbelt and turn up the radio. We're going on a road trip. I'm Glenn Moberg, and today on Route 51, we focus on the psychology of terrorism with one of the world's top experts on the subject, Dr. Anne Speckard, the author of a newly published 800-page volume entitled Talking to Terrorists, Understanding the Psychosocial Motivations of Militant Jihadi Terrorists, Mass Hostage Takers, Suicide Bombers, and Martyrs. Anne Speckard grew up in central Wisconsin, but she would set her sights on the broader world with her husband, Lieutenant Daniel Speckard, another Wisconsin native and a former guest on this show, who would serve as ambassador to Belarus and Greece. Dr. Speckard is a professor in the Department of Psychiatry at Georgetown University Medical Center, where she specializes in post-traumatic stress. While overseas, she began researching a special type of trauma victim, those who had been the victims of terrorism, whether through physical attacks or by being held hostage. And what followed was a broader study in which she interviewed over 400 terrorists, extremists, their supporters, hostages, family members, and close associates. And she did this in Lebanon, Palestine, Israel, Iraq, Jordan, Russia, Uzbekistan, Morocco, and Western Europe. Her interest is in finding out what makes terrorists tick, how they see the world, the experiences they have in common, and the way they see themselves. Anne Speckard joins us from the studios of WAMU in Washington, D.C., and as always, we invite you to join the conversation by giving us a call at 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. Anne, what's a nice girl from central Wisconsin doing in the kinds of places you've been in the course of writing this book?
It's a good question, Glenn, and sometimes I have to pinch myself when I listen to that description. And by the way, I have to say, hello, Wisconsin, hello, Wausau, and hi, Dad. But I just fell into it. I volunteered to go help with the hostages from the Moscow hostage taking, and the hostages told us in the first interviews, we sat right next to the women that had bomb belts strapped on, and at that moment I realized, my goodness, we have to ask about what did the hostage takers, the terrorists, say, because no one has ever interviewed a terrorist with a bomb strapped on. Well, we ended up getting secondary interviews through the hostages.
Well, I want to get into that in a second, but tell us first, just so people have an idea of your background, tell us a little bit about your childhood here in central Wisconsin, where you grew up, how you met Daniel, and how your lives took on a very different course from most of the people you grew up with.
Okay, well, I expected to be a normal girl. I grew up in Wausau on Maple Hill Drive. And I went to St. Matthew's Catholic school for the first 6 years, then John Muir, and then Wausau West, and followed the smart kids down to the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And I married my high school sweetheart, Daniel.
And Daniel grew up in Clintonville, correct?
No, he grew up in Wausau, but he was born in Clintonville.
Okay, got it.
And his dad was a teacher at Wausau West High School, a German teacher, and a very beloved teacher.
And is it true your dad was a math professor?
Mm-hmm. My dad was a math professor. And my mom died when I was little. I had a stepmother, but she was a stay-at-home mom, and that was my role model. And I expected that I'd be a nurse or a teacher or something where I'd raise my kids and, you know, have some kind of profession because I knew I was smart, but I never expected what I got.
And you got quite a bit, judging from the experiences that you recount in this really exhaustive volume. Now you write that in the course of your interviews, you discovered, and I'm quoting here, that terrorists are surprisingly normal in many ways and surprisingly human, that in interviewing them, you approach them as people and not monsters, and that they probably didn't enter this life endorsing violence. Can you explain how that is the case in light of another statement you make that there is never any excuse for or acceptable rationale for terrorism?
Well, I do believe that there is no excuse ever for targeting civilians, and that's how I define terrorism, intentionally targeting civilians. But what I learned when I went to approach terrorists and talk to them and I sat in their homes, sometimes I even overnighted in the homes of suicide terrorists that were already dead. Their family members told me, you won't be able to go back across the checkpoint. So if you want this interview, you'll have to agree to stay here tonight. And I did. So I had the chance to observe them in their family, at their meals, how they conducted themselves with their children. And they were surprisingly a lot like us. But I think what happens is that people follow slowly down a path where they begin to justify killing civilians for many reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And if you begin to follow a faulty logic, it can lead you to a very bad end.
What are some of the factors that terrorists have in common, the common experiences that they may have had early in life? You say that they didn't enter this life endorsing violence. What are the common experiences they had early in life before they became terrorists?
Well, I divide terrorists by motivations into two different sets. Those that are in conflict zones, so maybe Palestinians, Chechens, Kashmiris, Afghanis, people in Iraq. People that are growing up with active conflict, they've seen a lot of violence. They've seen homes destroyed. They've seen power grabs. They've seen territory taken. They may have family members that were killed or tortured or unjustly arrested. They themselves may have been detained and badly treated. So if you have those kind of experiences, your motivations are most likely going to be trauma and revenge driven. But then there's a whole other set of people that live in non-conflict zones. What about the terrorists that rise up in Europe, that rise up out of the slums of Casablanca, Morocco, terrorists that have risen up in our own country? What are their motivations? They're not living with violence on a daily basis. But then we have to ask ourselves, some of them are. Some of them are coming from violent homes. That can be a mini-conflict zone. Some of them are living in very violent neighborhoods, so they learn violence from an early age. But usually in the non-conflict zones, the recruiters are really good through videos and pictures of showing them pictures of the downtrodden and saying, these are your Muslim brothers and sisters. Oh, keep in mind that I studied militant jihadi terrorists, mm-hmm. So they're Muslim. And they say, these are your brothers and sisters. You have a duty to fight for them. And then they play upon, let's say you're a Moroccan second-generation immigrant in Brussels. They say, look, you can't get a job. They won't accept you into this society. You're marginalized, discriminated against. Look at Serbia. Look at what happened there. You have to be ready. Join us. And step by step, they take them down this path.
Well, in particular, when you're talking about the terrorists from conflict zones, you're talking about people who often were so traumatized by violence, in some cases by torture, by the deaths of their loved ones, that they wanted to end their own lives and commit suicide. Isn't it then just a short step to becoming a suicide bomber?
That's exactly right. And what I wrote about was that the militant jihadi ideology, the martyrdom ideology, I found was a psychological first aid for those kind of people. When we study suicide in general, just anywhere, even in Wausau, Wisconsin, we know that we can predict, the biggest predictor of suicide is if someone is in terrible, terrible emotional pain. And that's referred to by psychologists as psych ache. And if the pain is so overwhelming, you can't see any other options, you just want to exit life. Well, many people ask, are terrorists crazy? They're not crazy, but they might have really bad post-traumatic stress disorder from living in violence. So imagine you can't escape the violence. If you have PTSD, you're usually having flashbacks, bad dreams, nightmares. And if you lived in a peaceful area, you would try everything possible to avoid that so you wouldn't get flashbacks. But if you live in constant violence, you can't avoid your memories of it. So it's constantly in your mind, your body's constantly aroused, and you may be in such pain that when a recruiter comes to you and says, I can take you to a better place, you can exit life, and you can be a hero. Everybody's going to remember you. They're going to make a video of you. They're going to sing songs about you. You can get revenge for the things that you feel are wrong. You can win one for our side. The people in deep pain will resonate to that.
Is it true that it is against Islam to commit suicide, with the exception of if you kill yourself for your religion?
Well, there's debate on that. It depends who you ask, but mainstream Islam, well, Islam in general, any sect forbids suicide, just as Christianity does. But being killed for the sake of Islam, for the sake of Islamic lands, or to defend the Prophet or the Quran, is considered a great honor, and you immediately go to paradise.
Before we get into the specifics of your book, Anne, I want to ask you just a short question about torture. We've got a critically acclaimed movie out right now called Zero Dark Thirty about the hunt for Osama bin Laden, in which it's implied that torture helped American investigators find the suspect, find bin Laden. From your work in this field, is torture something that can help us catch terrorists, or is it something that creates terrorists?
I think it's both. I think that sometimes you can break a person with torture, and the justification that's usually used for torture is the ticking bomb theory, that if there's someone who knows about or is involved with a plot and a bomb is about to explode and many lives are going to be taken, it can be argued that that person can justifiably be tortured because to torture one person to save many is justified. And if indeed the person knows and you mistreat him, you may get the answer out of him and you may save lots of lives. But the argument to that theory is, do you have the right person? Does he indeed know? Is there a ticking bomb? And if you're wrong, you create more terrorists. And I can tell you many, many examples that I ran into where people became involved in terrorism as a result of torture.
What brought you to Russia, where you really got into this subject in a big way?
Well, I started with Russia because Daniel was first named ambassador in Belarus, so we both learned to speak Russian, and I'm a trauma expert. So I started hanging out with Nadia Tarabrina, who's the premier PTSD expert in Russia. And when the hostages were taken in Moscow, I sent her an email and I said, are you okay? Is your family okay? The hostages were held for 3 days.
Now, this was this was a Moscow movie theater and Chechen rebels taking over that theater. They took 800 hostages and Russian military forces eventually ended the incident by using gas. And it didn't end well for a lot of people. A lot of people were killed. Tell us about the incident.
It was actually a play. And during the beginning of the play, military people came on the stage, and everyone that went to the play, it was a commonly known novel that had been made into a play. So people expected the military people to come on the stage, but the Chechens had infiltrated, and they came on the stage. So at first, and they were yelling and shooting their guns into the air and saying, you're hostages, everyone remain in your seats. And they quickly ran down off the stage and encircled the hostages. And at first people thought, oh, this is a really cool special effect. You know, they're coming into the audience. And they didn't understand. But after a few people stood up or laughed and they got the butt of a rifle into their face and people were bleeding, they quickly understood that they had been taken hostage. They were held for 3 days with bombs, and the women wore bomb belts on. It was 20 women and 20 men that took over the theater.
They called these women the Black Widows. Why was that?
That was a moniker that journalists gave them, and they named them Black Widows because they were all dressed in black, and they assumed that they had lost their husbands because many Chechens had been killed in two wars of independence between Chechnya and Russia. And it was true for some of the women that they were widows, but the others had killed family members, but it wasn't their husbands.
Now, when the Russians, when the soldiers ended this, they threw gas into the theater, and you write that the Russians shot these Black Widows, the women. They'd been overcome by the gas. They were unconscious, and they just walked up to them as they were lying there and shot them point blank in the head. It's shocking to read something like that.
Yeah, it's cold-hearted, but the actual proper procedure for dealing with someone who's wearing a suicide vest is to shoot them in the head, because you don't want to shoot the vest because you'll cause an explosion. And the entire theater was rigged up with bombs. So if one of them exploded, the whole group would have exploded, and the people that were rescuing. So that was probably necessary. One thing that bothered me was that they broadcast the results of it on TV. They showed pictures of the women that had been shot in the head.
Is that something that might be counterproductive if you're trying to maintain peace with a population that's subservient to you?
You know, it depends. It's very interesting to think about counterterrorism, because the Russians managed to do it by being very heavy-handed. There's a lot less terrorism in Chechnya right now because they were extremely heavy-handed. And I don't think in our democracy we would ever stand for that. So it's not an answer for us, but it could work. And, of course, showing pictures of people that you've just killed, even if they were wrong, is probably likely to instigate others to join their ranks.
Now, you ended up, the original goal you had was to interview the surviving hostages of that incident. What challenges did you face, and what did you learn?
Well, I found right away that the woman that I was working with, we applied for an NIMH, that's National Institute of Mental Health, in the U.S. grant, and she became frightened of receiving U.S. money. So that was a challenge, because she had been a victim of Stalin when she was young, and she was afraid of being too involved with the U.S., I found that the Russian authorities weren't real happy to have an American come to help. We had to be, of course, very careful with the hostages because they'd been deeply traumatized. And when I went to Beslan to speak to the hostages there, I found that it wasn't easy to travel to Beslan. It was frowned upon. And I was interviewed by the FSB, which is their former KGB.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy I was with was terrified that we were going to get arrested.
You interviewed these hostages, and that led to a broader study of terrorists themselves. Tell me how that happened.
Well, the things that I've done, I've just kind of fallen into them by fate, because when we did the interviews in Moscow, there was a counterterrorism expert, a Russian, that we went to have dinner with, and within 5 or 10 minutes, I realized that he was a former KGB. And he told us, the Chechens did this because they're wild, horrible people. They have no real reasons other than they're just all killers. And I knew that that couldn't possibly be right, especially that there were 20 young women involved. I mean, why would 20 women go to a theater and strap on bomb belts mm-hmm. and be willing to kill other women and children? They had to have a good reason, right? And just by chance, the very next morning, a Chechen woman came. And she asked Nadia, my colleague, for assistance with her PhD studies. So I right away asked this woman, would you help us? Would you conduct interviews back in Chechnya with the family members, with the close associates? Because I'd like to know what put them on the terrorist trajectory. What made them into these people that were willing to go and sacrifice their own lives killing others? And that was our first step, actually, making what we started to call psychological autopsies of suicide terrorists.
And the hostages themselves gave you some insight into their captors.
Yes, they did. They had pretty long conversations, and they said that the Chechens told them that they were willing to die, that they had come to die, and they expected to die. They said the same thing in Beslan, but that they didn't want to kill the people that they had taken hostage. They just wanted their country to be free, and they wanted the Russians out. And they painted a pretty grim picture that, on the one hand, the hostages had some Stockholm effects. That's when you love your hostage taker because you're so scared. And it's probably a good thing to love your hostage taker for the time that you're
right.
under his power. But they also began to feel sympathy.
We're talking to Dr. Ann Speckhard. She is somebody who grew up in Warsaw and has become one of the top experts on post-traumatic stress, and now on the psychology of terrorism. She's got a book out called Talking to Terrorists. She's joining us from the studios of WAMU in Washington, D.C. We're taking your phone calls, 1-800-780-9742, if you'd like to join the conversation. That's 1-800-780-9742. I'm Glenn Mobrick. This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio on the Ideas Network.
Support for WPR comes from Rely Local Wausau, building the local economy and strengthening the community by making local business everybody's business. More about locally owned and operated businesses at relylocal.com.
I'm Glenn Mobrick. This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio on the Ideas Network. Our guest is Dr. Ann Speckard, who grew up in Wausau and has written an exhaustive volume. She interviewed 400 people for this, terrorists, hostages, family members, supporters, people who have had dealings with the hostages in one way or the other. The book is called Talking to Terrorists. We'd love to have you join the conversation because this is a lady who has discovered quite a bit about what makes terrorists tick, how they see the world, how their minds work. 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. And do you believe it's possible to rehabilitate terrorists?
Yes, I do. I actually think that it's harder to change someone that is a child sexual molester than it is to change a terrorist.
And how often does this happen?
How often are terrorists rehabilitated?
Correct. And in order to do that, what steps do you have to take?
It depends what the motivations are that the person engaged in terrorism to begin with. And if they're a militant jihadi terrorist, they've bought onto the ideology, which is a distorted form of Islam. So first of all, you have to show them, or on one level, you have to show them this isn't the correct Islam. And if they're very passionate and very religious, if you convince them of that, they can't continue on because their goal is paradise and they see, oh, that's not going to get me to paradise. Second, if you find out what motivated them into it, you have to address those issues. I mean, if their sister was killed, maybe they need to grieve. They need some help with traumatic bereavement, that kind of thing.
When you were doing the research for your book, how did you find the people that you interviewed and how did you get them to talk? And after you got them to talk, how did you know that they were telling you the truth?
Those are great questions. I must have some intuitive gift because I always went out on what's called a snowball sample. So I started just telling people the truth. I was always extremely honest and sincere about what I wanted. And I told people I was looking to speak to suicide terrorists, extremists, terrorist leaders. Sometimes I was actually looking for a certain person. And always I ended up interviewing someone else, so I had to be patient. And people were judging me during that time, watching me, seeing how I react. And gradually I won trust, and they introduced me to the next level, to the next level. And eventually I got down to the nitty-gritty, and I was interviewing people that were really scary. So I made a lot of background interviews to get to the real ones. And once I got in, I oftentimes was working with interpreters, but I had lived overseas for 10 years, and that's a skill to work with an interpreter. And I'm very good at reading body language. I learned a little bit of Arabic, not enough that I could ever understand what was being said, but I could understand if what the translator was translating was matching the body language and matching where we were going. And when all of them
that told you whether or not the translator could be trusted.
Right, because that's a whole issue. The translator could be lying to you and making up all kinds of things. And I was always paying my guides and translators. So, you know, they could have asked one of their friends to come and make crazy things and tell me crazy things. But one way of judging if people are telling you the truth, well, first of all, a lot of people would speak propaganda in the beginning. And I decided to listen to that and just be patient. So I let them exhaust themselves on telling me all kinds of terrorist propaganda and why the U.S. or why Israel or why whatever country they were against is a terrible country and on and on and on and all their propaganda. And I also asked them to tell me about themselves as a whole person. So to tell me about their childhood, to tell me how they grew up, to tell me about their life dreams. And most people got really hooked on themselves. Because think about it, if somebody sat down with you and said, tell me all about yourself, and was really interested, and then also was psychologically trained so they knew how to ask you good questions, you'd probably get into it. And after a while, I could see that they were very enthusiastically interacting with me and very sincerely speaking. And sometimes I'd say, okay, you told me about this experience. Is that what motivated your decision point here? And sometimes they'd say, oh, no, you have that all wrong. It was this. So they became very enthusiastic in trying to figure themselves out. And they seemed to really enjoy having that opportunity.
While you were doing your research, there were times when you were accused of being a CIA agent. How often did that happen, and how did that affect the research you were doing?
I think everywhere I went, people, especially after I left, because I think I'm easy to trust, and I think because I was honest and sincere, they could read that in my body language, that they did trust me, and they often told me a lot more than what they had intended to tell me, because they did get so enthusiastically into it. But after I left, then they started wondering, who is she really? So I learned that maybe it wasn't good to go for return interviews, and I would hear from the guides, people were asking questions about you, who you're working for, after I left. One time, I was surrounded by a whole crowd of young people in Morocco that were telling me about the Casablanca bombers, and suddenly it went quiet, and the translator turned to me, and he said, they want to know who you are and where you're from, meaning, who do you work for?
Mm-hmm.
And I knew exactly what the question was, so I answered. I looked at everybody that was surrounding me, and they could have just crushed me and killed me right there in the slum. And I answered CIA and Mossad and started laughing. The translator almost fainted. And he was like, are you crazy? But the reason I answered that way is because, in a way, it's a psychological technique to name their fear. And I turned to the translator and I said, that's what they're all afraid of. And when I started laughing, like, isn't that ridiculous? They laughed too then.
Oh boy, weren't you worried about, you know, telling a joke like that and having it be misconstrued?
After the fact, when I wrote up my notes, Glenn, when I wrote this book, it took me a long time because I was really freaked out when I looked at my notes. And I think while I was doing it, I'm a real people person, and I was locked onto the people. I was listening to them. I was in their context. I was experiencing a lot of what they experience. In the West Bank and Gaza, I was mistaken for a Palestinian, oftentimes by Israeli soldiers who pointed guns in my face, who ordered me to get out of minibuses, and until they saw my American passport, were treating me pretty roughly. And I don't know.
You write about a CIA agent who actually tried to recruit you in Israel. How often has that happened to you?
I don't know. A couple of times. And both times I told them I wasn't interested at all. And, you know, then they always backtrack as though they didn't really mean it. So
Let's talk about one interview that you got involving the Beslan crisis in Ossetia. You know, this mm-hmm. is an autonomous republic within the Russian Federation. And during the crisis, the terrorists shot most of the healthy men, you write. But you interviewed one, a gentleman named Aslan, who escaped while his mother and daughter were still inside the school. And later his mother died. How did you get through to him? Many journalists tried to interview him, and he was annoyed by them. How did you gain his confidence? How did you break through?
Well, I always used local guides, so part of it was they made the phone calls and said, I have this woman here that wants to interview you. And number one, I wasn't a journalist, so that was oftentimes an answer to people, because they would say, I've had a lot of journalists come and interview me and then write up a terrible interview, and I don't want that experience again. And I would say, I'm not a journalist, I'm a psychologist. I had lived in Belarus for a couple of years. I understood their traditions, and one of their traditions is if they're talking about something with a lot of grief, they drink. And he got the alcohol, and they always make cheers. So mm-hmm. as he told us his story, he got out some hard alcohol and poured it for all of us. And they make these very heartbreaking toasts. And I made a toast as well to his surviving family. The story was so sad about Aslan. Every year, all the kids gather, and they have a coming back to the school celebration, and that was the day of the coming back celebration. And his little girl had been on his shoulder, and she had been chosen for the honor of ringing the bell to start the school year. And just as they were about to do that, the terrorists came swarming in. And he's so lucky that his wife and child did survive, and that he did, because he had been taken up to a room where they shot everyone else, but he had the strength of mind to understand what was going to happen, and he jumped out a window. And he was shot at as he jumped out the window. He landed on a pile of corpses, ran like crazy, and the Russians covered him with tear gas.
The hostages reported that terrorists actually prayed in that incident after taking people's lives, that somehow they felt guilty for the actions that nonetheless they continued to carry out. Can you explain that to me?
Yeah, they're not psychopaths, that they're cold and unfeeling, at least the ones that I interviewed about. They're very passionate people. They're fighting for a political cause. In this case, they were fighting to free their country. And the Beslan tragedy has some roots in ethnic cleansing. There were some Ingush that were present that had been the victim of Assyrians during ethnic cleansing. So there were some aspects of revenge. And when they killed people, they did feel bad about it, and they prayed in the sense for absolution.
We're talking to Dr. Anne Speckhard. She has written a volume called Talking to Terrorists. She's an adjunct professor at Georgetown University. She's interviewed 400 terrorists, hostages, family members, and those associated with them for this book. It's a fascinating read. And Anne Speckhard grew up right here in Wausau. I'm Glenn Mobrig. This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio. If you'd like to join the conversation, 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from UMR, a United Healthcare company providing Employee Benefits Administration, Integrated Health Management, and Pharmacy Benefits Administration for self-funded employers throughout the U.S. More about UMR at umr.com.
1-800-780-9742 if you'd like to talk to Anne Speckhard, the author of a book called Talking to Terrorists. And Anne, we've been hearing a lot about drone strikes right now as a means of carrying out policy in the Mideast. What happens when innocent people are killed by these drones? With the research that you've done on this, is this something that may be creating more terrorists?
Well, it's an interesting question because the Obama administration is saying that they have decapitated or nearly decapitated the leadership of Al-Qaeda, and that's great. We want Al-Qaeda to go away. But on the other hand, all of the ideologues and the ideology of Al-Qaeda already lives on in the Internet. And that will be there for a good long time. And many people can still learn from those people. So killing them doesn't necessarily make them go away. And if we kill them with a lot of collateral damage, everyone in their village, their relatives, may feel a desire to revenge. And it only takes one or two to replace them. Of course, they don't have the technical knowledge. They don't have the contacts yet. But they may grow up to become the next generation. And I'm not saying growing up from five-year-olds, growing up from maybe a 20-year-old that at age 24 may be the next terrorist leader.
Now, before the break, we were talking about the Beslan crisis. You interviewed three young boys who had been hostages during that incident. How does being a victim of terrorism affect children?
Well, that's a really touching question, and it made me think a lot when I saw the victims of Sandy Hook, because when I made the interviews of the Beslan hostages, I went home to my hotel room, and I sobbed uncontrollably. It was the saddest thing. And children carry that with them forever. I mean, one of those little boys, he got out, but his sister didn't. And the mother told me that the night before, both of his sisters didn't. She said the night before, the sister had some strange intuition, and she said, "Mommy, I don't want to go to school tomorrow." And the mother blamed herself, "Why didn't I listen to her?" But, you know, think of all the times our kids tell us, "Mommy, I don't want to do that." And somehow that child had a really bad feeling and didn't want to go to school. And she didn't come back.
Child abuse is often cited as a factor in creating terrorists. Yet you know of militants to whom that hasn't happened, and you know of victims that didn't become terrorists. To what extent, in your opinion, does childhood abuse lead to militancy? And what's the secret for those that aren't affected that way?
Well, when we think of terrorism, we have to think of four levels. There's a group, and there's an ideology, and there's social support, and then there's an individual with vulnerabilities. So if you take a person that's been child abused, he's experienced violence. The gateways to violence have been opened for him. He may see it as legitimate, an answer. He may have identified with the person that carried out violence, and he may think that's a good thing. And it may be a way that he copes with feeling powerless, that he engages in violence. So if he comes in contact to a group that is saying this is a good thing and pulls him into the ideology that justifies engaging in violence, he's a perfect person to do that to. But there's plenty of people that experience violence. Daniel and I lived in Belarus, and that society was very oppressed, still is. There's a lot of violence that was done to those people. And they don't have terrorism because there's no groups and no ideology.
You spoke to the father of Habash Hanani. Am I pronouncing his name correctly?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
A 17-year-old Palestinian who carried out a mission on an Israeli settlement was killed. Hanani's father, like many parents of so-called martyrs, expressed pride at his son's death. Can you explain how a father can feel that emotion?
Yeah, and I think that that's something I really learned in the West Bank and Gaza, that the way that parents find out about their kids going on suicide missions is really horrible. Usually the kids don't tell their parents. Parents have no idea, as with most things that kids do that parents may not agree with. But when it happens, the entire village comes, the terrorist group comes, and either the television announces to them that their child has gone as a suicide terrorist, or the group comes and tells, and the entire village comes to congratulate them and say, "Your son is a hero for us. He scored one for us." Well, the parent in that particular moment goes along with it and says, "Yes, my son's a hero." And it's probably just like someone finding out on our side that their child has died for the military. They may be overcome with grief, but when the TV cameras are on them, they're going to say, "Yes, my son is a hero, and he died in behalf of our country." And then they're going to go inside their house and have their private opinion. And most parents that I talked to, when they were able to share their private opinion, were angry at the terrorist group, were angry that their son or daughter had gone to do that, and were terribly bereaved.
I'm Glenn Mobrig. This is Route 51, Regional Talk Radio on the Ideas Network. Our guest today, Ann Speckard, a native of Wausau, who has spent the last several years studying international terrorism. She has published an 800-page book called Talking to Terrorists. Ann, tell us about one of your students, Ken, who was almost killed in a bombing at Hebrew University in Israel. This young man apparently carried quite a bit of psychological baggage with him following the incident.
Ken came to my class. I was teaching in Brussels, and I was teaching a class that day on PTSD, and he said, "I think I have this PTSD thing." And I asked him, "Why, Ken?" And he completely surprised me. He said, I went to Israel as an exchange student. On my first day there, I went to have lunch. I went into a cafeteria in Hebrew University, got into a little argument with an Israeli soldier, and as a European, he was more pro-Palestinian, and he argued for the Palestinians, and the Israeli soldier said, "You haven't seen death, you haven't had your friends killed. Live here for a while, you'll change your mind." Ken walked out of the cafeteria. The thing blew up. Everyone inside was killed. It's horrible.
And he carried that with him. It affected the way he conducted himself in class. He did some role-playing with you, and it's obvious that when something like that happens to somebody, or even almost happens to it, it's not easy to forget.
No, Ken will carry that his whole life, and he was very ashamed because in the moment it happened, he became totally frozen. He just overwhelmed, and he was ashamed that he didn't help. So then months later, he went and signed up for first aid training, and he went with the ambulances to the other sites where there were bombs because there were quite a few in Jerusalem that year. That was at the height of the Second Intifada, and he helped. He learned martial arts training so that he'd always be ready. He made a decision when he was traveling on the buses in Jerusalem, if anybody came on and screamed Allah Akbar, which is what they scream, it's God is great, right before they explode themselves, he wasn't willing to sacrifice himself, but he had decided who on the bus he would throw in front of the bomber to throw the bomber off the bus and thereby save everyone else, including himself.
That's an amazing story, and it's like so much in this book. It's hard to believe, but it makes sense when you get into the psychology of people who have been affected by this phenomenon. You write quite a bit about Western Europe as well as the situations in the old Russian republics and in the Middle East. And you talk about the spread of jihadist ideology among the youth of South London, and that converting to radical Islam sometimes serves as a protection from violence. How is that the case?
Well, in some of the gangs in South London, it's difficult to cross gang areas, and they're usually delineated by postal codes. So if you're just in a gang and you try to cross over to another postal code, you may be killed. And if you're a girl, you may be surrounded by a bunch of boys that on the phones, at least in Europe, if they take your phone, they can identify your address. And they'll say really disgusting things like, I know your address, tomorrow night I'm coming with my guys, and we're going to rape you. Make sure you have a few girlfriends there. And if you don't, I'm coming to kill you. And they're serious. So I met a guy that was working with these kids, and he said they had been taken to a training camp in the woods by a jihadi. And the jihadi separated the girls from the boys, and he told the girls, you need to put on headscarves. The girls are already dressing in really baggy clothing because they didn't want to attract sexual attention.
Yeah.
And they said, you're right to dress conservatively. And boys, you need to respect these girls and never put a hand on them. So it's a protection. And then the boys learned, when you cross the postal codes, if you say salam alaikum, which is peace be with you, it's an Islamic greeting, and wassalam alaikum back, it's a free passage. You won't be attacked.
And in Belgium, where you taught for a number of years, you write that Moroccan people, citizens of Moroccan descent, were discriminated against, and that drew them to a radical jihadist ideology. What kind of discrimination do they face in Belgium? Is it really that bad in what we perceive to be a civilized, progressive country?
Belgium's a lovely country, and I really enjoyed living there, but I was shocked by how the immigrants of Moroccan descent are treated. There you can go nightclubbing at age 15, so my girls were nightclubbing, and they told me, and my students told me, that professor, when I go to the nightclubs, I can get in because I'm white. But if the Moroccan kids come, and they typically, the boys, go in groups of five or six or maybe 10, if they come to the door, the bouncer says, go home Moroccan, and won't let them in. And I couldn't believe it. So I went and sat outside these nightclubs, and unfortunately my students recognized me and came and bought me a beer, so that a little bit interfered with the research. But I did see it with my own eyes. And it's terrible. And I spoke to the head of the discrimination. I don't remember his title exactly, but head of anti-discrimination about it once at a conference, and said, how can this go on? How can you have systematic discrimination when it comes to clubbing? And he said, well, those are the kids that cause all the problems in the nightclubs. And I thought, that's not an answer. And it's not only nightclubbing, it's also in jobs, it's in renting an apartment. It's pretty systematic.
You know, it sounds like some of the discrimination that has taken place historically in America. Let's talk briefly about Iraq. We're running out of time, but you were asked by contractors in that country to develop a rehabilitation program for militant detainees. What were the biggest challenges you faced there?
Oh, my. The biggest challenge I faced was the contractors and the people that were on the ground as the contractors. I'm sure they were good people, but they just didn't get it. And one of them would speak about that Islam is the devil's religion. And we were trying to use, as I told you earlier, imams that would challenge the jihadis to say, this isn't the correct Islam. And they were wonderful people. And we were lucky enough that we got three guys that, when Iraq was invaded, they joined al-Qaeda, not because they believed in al-Qaeda, but because they wanted to influence al-Qaeda from the inside. They were imams, and they wanted to temper them and stop them from going too far. So they were against the beheadings, they were against bombing civilians, but they weren't against fighting military to military, you know, thinking of themselves as military. And they were arrested and in our prison, and I recruited these three imams to work with us, and the contractors couldn't accept them. They decided, no, they had been already in a movement that they're going to kill us, they're double agents, they're this, they're that. Although our military and our three-letter agency had investigated them and said, no. And these were people that were willing to risk their own lives to work with us and willing to risk the lives of their families who were living in Baghdad at the time. And can you imagine if they were standing up against al-Qaeda? Their families would be slaughtered in 1 minute if it was discovered. And one of them was killed for working with us.
Amazing story. And you grew up as a Catholic. You talk about being told the stories of martyrs and the honor involved in dying for God. Did that help you understand some of the people you interviewed for this book?
I think it did. Sometimes I look back and I think I was a very voracious reader as a child, and I read every martyr book in our library, and it was a big room. So I must have read thousands of martyr books. And, of course, these were martyrs that died for standing up for the faith. They didn't die to kill other people. But, yeah, I understand people that are passionate about their faith and that are willing to put their earthly life in behalf of what they believe.
You also write, here's a quote, "We have seen Christianity and Judaism also manipulated to create fanatics and terrorists who have shot abortion clinic doctors, bombed abortion clinics, or attacked Muslims bending in prayer. Fanaticism is not limited to only one religion."
That's definitely true. And one of the best ways to manipulate people is through religion because, you know, most of us take our religious beliefs quite seriously.
And if somebody wants to get your book, where can they get it?
It's on Amazon and Barnes & Noble, so they can order it. I would love it if our local bookstore would stock it. And it's also on the Kindle, the Nook, the Kobo, and it soon should be on the iPad. And you kept saying it's 800 pages, but I'd like to answer that I think it's an easy read.
It is an easy read.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's filled with stories. It's not an academic book.
And just listening to the trauma faced by many of your interviews, it must have taken a great emotional toll on you. How did you deal with the burden?
I think I was energized by it because it was something so fascinating to understand. And I felt a real privilege that people trusted me and opened up and told me their stories. The hardest thing was to write it because when I was back home with all this paper, and we moved three times during the time I was writing it, we moved from Greece to New York and then to Washington, D.C., I was frightened as I went through my notes and sometimes found it hard to sit at my computer and write up the stories.
It is indeed a fascinating read. Ann Speckhard, thank you so much for being with us today. Ann is an adjunct professor at the Department of Psychiatry at Georgetown University Medical Center. She grew up in Wausau. She's the author of Talking to Terrorists, Understanding the Psychosocial Motivations of Militant Jihadi Terrorists, Mass Hostage Takers, Suicide Bombers, and Martyrs. You can find out more about Ann at her website, AnnSpeckhard.com. I'm Glenn Moberg of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks so much for being with us today. Our executive producer, Rick Ryer, our show producer, Ida Sophie Winter, and our on-air producer, Jane Ritger. Thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. Next week on Route 51, we revisit the issue of gun control and Second Amendment rights in the wake of the elementary school shooting in Connecticut and the push by the Obama administration for new gun laws and restrictions. Thanks for riding along with us today. Forward, as we say in Wisconsin. And until next week, we are heading out of town.